You can go to 526 Market Street in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and see the Liberty Bell. And this very iconic symbol, the Liberty Bell, has an inscription. The inscription says, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Now that draws from Leviticus 25, verse 10. And so there you have, in this iconic symbol of liberty, a drawing on a biblical passage that deals with liberty in Leviticus 25. And this chapter is important for that subject, the subject of liberation, the subject of restoration. And so in Leviticus 25, we're going to look at a chapter that is very hope-giving to the Israelites. The Israelites were living in a time where they could find themselves economically destitute, financially destitute, and they would need to be able to lift themselves from the debts they were in. They needed to be able to work the debts that they had incurred. They needed to be able to do faithful labor and be able to cover their expenses. And so the servitude and the contractual labor had an end point, a year of jubilee that would restore and reset the lives of the Israelites. The year of Jubilee is the main subject of Leviticus 25. It's important in later parts of the Old Testament, and it's important in terms of the ministry of Jesus. So I think understanding the year of Jubilee is not just interesting for this book because we're nearing the end of our study in Leviticus. I think it will help us to greatly appreciate the gospel and see the power of Jesus's kingdom news. And the basic idea of Jubilee is that it was the 50th year that was different from the previous years in Israel's life. This was a resetting of the Israelites to being debt-free, no longer in contractual labor, and any property or homes that had been sold were restored to the family name and clans, whereas debt and other economic struggles might bring great overwhelming grief to a family, the year of Jubilee was something that they knew would come in the 50th year. And so in verses 1 to 7, the year of Jubilee is set up by laws about the Sabbath year, and then that will build into the Jubilee year. Verses 1 to 7 teach us about a Sabbath year. In verse 1, it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying these following words." And in chapter 26, at the very end, it tells us these are the statutes and rules and laws that the Lord made between himself and the people of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai. I think the beginning of chapter 25 and the end of chapter 26 should suggest to us that these two chapters will go together. We'll see in our chapter, our sermon on Leviticus 26, how that works. But chapter 25 and 26 will go together with some common themes. This also links us to the spot of Mount Sinai, which is unusual given that there's a tabernacle God has already spoken to Moses from and multiple times. God is revealing still from the mountain to Moses some instructions. And these laws about a Sabbath year or the seventh year are part of these instructions. So in verse 2, it tells us, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord." Now, you're expecting the people to keep a Sabbath. Exodus prepares us for this. It draws upon the creation pattern of rest on the seventh day. And we're expecting that the people of Israel will not do work on the seventh day. This tells us that the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord in verse 2. This is some interesting language because how does the land keep Sabbath? Well, one of the ways the land is used during the years of agricultural activity is that there's plowing and there's sowing and planting and there's watering and caring for the soil. For a land to keep Sabbath means the land is not doing those normal things. It will mean on the seventh year that the land is given rest. This is what it means for the land to keep Sabbath to the Lord. All of Israel's life then has these important time markers for their calendar, their weekly observance of the Sabbath and a seventh year, so that you have a counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In the seventh year, the land will keep a Sabbath to the Lord. It tells us in verse 3, for 6 years, you shall sow your field. And that means you're going to be engaging in the normal work like a farmer would. You're going to be sowing the field. You're going to be preparing for the crops. And for 6 years, you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. This means that the cycles of plowing and harvesting are happening year round, year after year, except in verse 4, in the seventh year. In the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest, or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. Notice what it's covering there. It's covering vineyards. It's covering harvesting the ground, whether it be grapes or other things. You have a year of rest. That's how the land will keep Sabbath. In verse 6, the Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself, and for your male and female slaves, and for your hired servant and the sojourner who lives with you, and for your cattle and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food. This means the people are living off what would have been the natural produce or the leftover produce from the land. The Lord will ensure that the land has provided enough food for the people in the seventh year. So if the people work years 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and then they fear, wait, if we don't plow and harvest in the seventh year, how are we going to eat? The Lord assures them that the Sabbath of the land will provide food for them. They will just not be engaging in the normal plowing and sowing, harvesting work themselves off new crops. They're going to have the leftover produce from the land that they will be able to live off. And this is the Lord's provision. So those first 7 verses are important for the Jubilee year, because these 7 verses lay out for us a 7-year cycle. Now, what happens if 7 years are followed by 7 years, followed by 7 years, followed by 7 years? You're going to be getting multiple Sabbath years for the land, multiple 7-year rests. However, if you get enough of those 7-year cycles going, that's going to accumulate to this culminating year called the Jubilee year. Now, verses 8 through 17 give us the laws about this Jubilee year. Let's look at it. In verse 8, you shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. So right there in verse 8, the Bible's doing a little bit of math for us, right? Doing some multiplication. It's saying 7 times 7, that's going to give you 49 years. And then in verse 9, you shall sound the trumpet, the loud trumpet, on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land. This is the marking of, in that 50th year, of the Jubilee. But it's not just on any day or any month. Look very carefully in verse 9 of when the Jubilee year begins. It says the 7th month. The 7th month is in Leviticus 23, part of those fall festivals that are crucial for Israel's life. And the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. This means that it's the most important day of Israel's year, the Day of Atonement, and Leviticus 23 addresses that day, as well as Leviticus 16. On the Day of Atonement, in the 50th year, after 7 cycles of 7 years has happened, the Jubilee year and the Day of Atonement coincide. This means that this is a kind of liberation and reconciliation and restoration that the Day of Atonement is a picture of. Jubilee is part of God's ceremonial patterning or foreshadowing of the grace and liberty we need as sinners. And so in verse 10, you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. That should sound familiar from that Liberty Bell inscription in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that I mentioned at the beginning of the sermon. In verse 10, this shall be this year a jubilee for you, when each of you shall return to his property, and each of you shall return to his clan. Now, a good question for a reader is, wait a second, why would you be returning to your property, and why might you be returning to your clan? Where did you go, and why were you not with your property? It's very, the scenario for the Israelites is that because of contractual labor that was necessary, they would have to sell their property and even put themselves into contractual labor agreements for years to work off their debts. Part of the way the Lord allowed financial relief to come to the Israelites is through labor that they themselves would go through, exercise, and financial relief through selling property or homes. But apparently, the property selling, the home selling, and the contractual labor was only temporary. According to verse 10, the Jubilee year resets this. So if you had entered into an indentured servitude, a labor that was going to pay off your debts, those came to an end when the Jubilee year arrived. If you had sold your house or if you had sold your property, those return to you in the Jubilee year. This is so different than something that we would practice in the United States or elsewhere in the world. This is different from what the Canaanites would experience. Something about the Jubilee year was signaling to the Israelites greater themes of restoration and debt release and forgiveness than might be, you know, initially apparent to us. In verse 11, that 50th year shall be Jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a Jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field. What verses 11 and 12 are essentially forbidding is the agricultural work that previous years would involve. Instead, you're to give rest to the land, and especially in this Jubilee year, no sowing or reaping. In verse 13, in this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you make a sale, in verse 14, to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. This might mean someone could try to charge a high amount for property that might not be used, but for a few years because of a coming Jubilee year. It might also mean someone could undersell. This is a warning then in verse 14, not to do what is wrong in terms of buying land. The value and the usefulness of the land is to be thought out with the guidepost being the year of Jubilee. In other words, the closer you are to the year of Jubilee, the more reasonable and lower a price for a house or land or your work as a servant needs to be. The same thing is true if the year of Jubilee is far off. That would increase the price of the land and the home, and that's because it would be in your possession or leased to you longer. You're not to use these opportunities to defraud or exploit someone financially. The year of Jubilee is to be a guidepost to inform how much you charge for something. In verse 15, you shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the Jubilee. And that means when a Jubilee has ended, there's another one coming up. So given the number of years between Jubilees, you're to proportion that out financially. And shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. In verse 16, if the years are many, you shall increase the price. And if the years are few, you shall reduce the price. For it is the number of the crops that he is selling to you. In verse 17, you shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. What verse 17 is saying is, well, God knows your business dealings. And the year of Jubilee for the Israelites was to help them not take advantage of their neighbor, but instead to engage in fair dealing and transactions and contractual agreements. The Lord knows, and they should fear the Lord and love their neighbor. Now, verses 18 to 22 build on what we've seen so far. They're going to assure provision for God's people. Verses 18 to 22, the assurance of provision sounds like this. Therefore, you shall do all my statutes and keep my rules and perform them. And then you will dwell in the land. securely. Now, part of the law keeping that the Israelites had to engage in included these instructions about the year of Jubilee. This was not optional. This was something the Israelites were to take seriously as part of their duty to fulfill the Lord's law. And in verse 19, the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. So they can count on being members of the land, that promised land. They can count on its crops providing for their family, and they need to trust the Lord, fear the Lord, love their neighbor, look forward to the year of Jubilee, and anything that need to be sold or contractual labor that needs to be established needs to be fairly thought out proportionally, depending on where you are between Jubilee years. And in verse 20, if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year? This reminds us of these first seven verses. What shall we eat in the seventh year if we may not sow or gather in our crop? Verse 21, he says, I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. And this means for the sixth year and then for the seventh year that you would be not sowing. And then for the following year after that, when you would return to sow but not have a harvest yet, God would ensure that in that sixth year, you would have enough crops to last you several years. So trust the Lord. The Lord's blessing would be upon his people. And in verse 22, when you sow in the eighth year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the ninth year when its crop arrives. This is, if you were to chart this out, this is the Lord saying, before that sabbatical for the land happens, you will have enough crops due to my bountiful blessing that you will last through not only the Sabbath of the land, but the following year of sowing, you will be able to have enough until the new crop arrives that year that follows. This is assurance of provision. So in these first 22 verses, what have we seen? The Israelites are going to dwell in the promised land. And they are going to have debts that they incur. And one of the ways that the Israelites might be able to relieve their debts temporarily is to enter into a contract of labor, indentured servitude. They would be able to sell property. But this is a temporary situation leading to the year of Jubilee when these things are reset. It's as if debts are released and canceled. This is picturing for us a deeply theological truth, because as sinners in a fallen world, we are accumulating daily debt apart from the work of Christ in us, debts of sin, wages that we deserve of death and condemnation because of our iniquity. We need our debts released. We need, if you will, a spiritual jubilee. We need our accusations and valid state of guilt to be overcome by a merciful declaration of the Lord's atoning hand. This year of Jubilee, then, is preparing us for the Messiah, and it's preparing us for the New Testament gospel news that in Christ there is forgiveness of our debts. We even think with the Lord's Prayer, you know, forgive us our debts, and as we forgive our debtors. We'll think about that notion of forgiveness in just a bit. Beginning in verse 23 to the end of the chapter, there are laws that govern the redeeming of people and property. Since you could sell property, including your land or home, and you could also, as a person, be contracted into some kind of temporary labor for months or years, this would mean you could be redeemed out of that situation ahead of time. In verses 23 to 55, these are laws for redeeming property and people. What we'll see is these are measures. These situations exist because of measures people take in their poverty. They are in a financially destitute situation where they need to acquire income, resources, provision for themselves and for their family. And so we'll see several if statements, that if someone is in this poor situation, here is what they will do. And it starts out with selling property, and by the time these verses end, we're dealing with people who have had to be serving as workers and laborers. In verses 23 and 24, here the stage is set. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me, and in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. So the Lord is saying to the people, the land belongs to me. And as long as you are in the land, it's more like you're tenants of the land. It's like you've come where someone else owns the property and you are to be a faithful steward and tenant of that role and responsibility in the land. So in verse 23, when it says the land shall not be sold in perpetuity, this means that if a debt is going to be paid off by selling the land, that's not a permanent situation. For the land is mine, the Lord says. You are strangers and sojourners. The Lord then is the king of the land. He owns the land. He owns the people. He's redeemed them from Egypt. They belong to him. And as king over the promised land, he can instruct and guide them on how to manage it any way he deems wise. In verse 24, in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. This means people can be delivered from and released from their debts and obligations, having suffered financially for whatever reason. Now let's give some examples. Here's an if statement. In verse 25, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. Becomes poor. It doesn't tell us why. Somebody might become poor because they're sick and no longer able to work. They might be at a certain age, or there might be other natural causes around them. That means someone has now become economically poverty. And if your brother becomes poor, one way he might deal with that situation is he sells some of his property. Because that means someone, a buyer, is going to get property and he's going to get money that he needs. That doesn't mean he sells all of his property. It says here he sells part of his property. So someone might look at their land and say, I don't need to sell all of it. I might be able to sell just some of it in order to get the money I need to cover my life. And in verse 25, if your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. This is a principle of redemption, and it's about financially delivering someone. It's knowing that I've sold property, and therefore I have not been able financially to keep it. But I may have a relative, a near relative, who knows of my situation, who knows I sold the property, and they are able to pay the money necessary for that property to come back to me. In other words, I've had a debt that I've incurred, and then the property is sold to cover my debt, and then it's redeemed by a near relative. That person is called a redeemer, a kinsman redeemer. The nearest relative shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. This means the Israelites are to think of themselves as a family, and these clans and these biological units were to think of themselves as their brother's keeper. And that even means financially their brother's keeper. So that if they saw a relative in a destitute situation where that relative had to sell land, for example, they, if they had the means to do so, could intervene, redeem the property, cover the person's debt, and give him that land that he thought he had to sell. One instance of this is in the book of Ruth. If you see in the book of Ruth, at the very end, Boaz is one of the family redeemers in Naomi and Ruth's family. And while in Ruth 4, there was a nearer redeemer who could have seen the situation as something to his advantage, that redeemer chose to pass. And so it ended up falling to Boaz. But Boaz was able to see a destitute situation and become the kinsman redeemer for the people. The idea of being a redeemer is also an Exodus idea, because the Israelites were oppressed and enslaved in the country of Egypt. And the Lord acted as their redeemer. He saw their situation and he did what was necessary to bring them out of that situation and give them an inheritance. This was an act of grace on God's part. He acted as Israel's redeemer. And because God is Israel's redeemer, in a micro sense, they are to care for one another's needs and act and imitate the Lord like micro redeemers, caring for people, seeing a need, and if they're able to help that, being able to redeem property for someone, part of property. In verse 26, if a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it. Let him calculate the years since he sold it and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it and then return to his property. In verses 26 and 27, this is saying there was a time when this Israelite needed to sell part of his land. But all of a sudden things turn around. And while no one else had to redeem his land, he becomes enriched financially. And he's able to buy back, he's able to pay a reasonable amount to get a return of his land to him so that he becomes the owner once more. In verse 28, but if he has not sufficient means to recover his land, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee, it shall be released and he shall return to his property. This means if you have had to forsake your property as an Israelite, you were only leaving it temporarily. The year of Jubilee was coming, and whatever debt or economically distressing situation you were in, the Lord was going to provide for you a liberty, a declaration, a proclamation of release. And you were going to be able to return to that property. In verses 29 and following, if a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, he may redeem it within a year of its sale. For a full year, he shall have the right of redemption. If it's not redeemed within a full year, then the house in the walled city shall belong in perpetuity to the buyer throughout his generations. It shall not be released in the Jubilee. But the houses of the villages that have no wall around them shall be classified with the fields of the land. They may be redeemed, and they shall be released in the Jubilee. So we enter an exception here. There are reasons why somebody might wall a city, and therefore houses that are sold are inside the jurisdiction of a walled city. And that symbolically, this wall seems to symbolically remove the same kinds of principal redemption act that is applicable to other parts of the land or other houses. The walled nature of the dwelling house within it. A dwelling house in a walled city might be redeemed up to a year. If you had to sell a house, you had up to a year for someone to redeem it for you or for you to develop the means and prosperity to redeem it. But if a year passed, that house within the walled city belonged to that buyer from that point forward. Verse 31 says, the houses of villages with no wall around them shall be classified with the fields of the land. So it's as if the houses are like the fields. They can be returned to the seller unless they are walled. It tells us that these houses without a wall around the village may be redeemed in verse 31 and shall be released in the Jubilee. This means if you sold a house and it was not in a walled city, someone in your family could redeem it for you. You could develop the means to get it back, or you could wait till the year of Jubilee if no redemption was possible to that point. And in the year of Jubilee, it'd be released. In verse 32, here's another matter that's going to be important for later books, the books of Numbers and Joshua especially. The book of Joshua, where the Israelites and the tribe of Levi in particular are going to be gleaning from and inhabiting the land. The Levites are going to be given cities. The Levites don't have a piece of property like the other Israelite tribes have. The Levites are the ones from whom the priests will come, and the Levites will have different cities. These are towns or cities that are in view in verse 32. It says, as for the cities of the Levites may redeem them at any time, may redeem at any time the houses in the cities they possess. And if one of the Levites, in verse 33, exercises his right of redemption, then the house that was sold in a city they possess shall be released in the Jubilee. For the houses in the cities of the Levites are their possession among the people of Israel. But the fields of the pasture land belonging to their cities may not be sold, for that is their possession forever. So while the Levites are guaranteed this option for redemption, it's limited. It doesn't include the pasture lands. And that is probably because other people besides the Levite families are going to be grazing their flocks on the pasture lands. So it needs to belong to more people, not just the Levite clan or family. In verse 35, if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. So in verse 35, if you're wondering as a reader, okay, is it saying that if my family member, my fellow Israelite, can't support himself, he or she is coming to live with me? That's exactly what verse 35 is saying. If your brother becomes poor, this means that they have no other way to, this would assume a selling of the land. This would assume a selling of property and house. This would leave them with no place. And in verse 35, if they become poor in the situation that they cannot maintain themselves, you shall support him as if he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. He's to be like a sojourner in the way that sojourners don't own property. They're just traveling through somewhere. All of a sudden, you have a family member who's become like a sojourner, a stranger to the land. He's a landless person, landless person that needs a place to live. And the brother's keeper principle in verse 35 is applied to him. In verse 36, take no interest from him or profit. So interest is financial. It doesn't mean don't pay attention to or show any investment in the person. It means financial interest. It says take no interest in verse 36 or profit, but fear your God that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. As a family member, he's saying, don't take advantage of other relatives who are not in a position, given their vulnerability, to be pushed deeper into debt. If you start bringing in a family member and you're thinking in Leviticus 25 here about interest and profiting from them financially, they weren't in a good financial state to begin with. That's why they have no property or house anymore, and that's why they're with you. So don't compound the difficulty of their situation by trying to gain more money from them. Instead, it says in verse 37, fear the Lord. Or verse 38, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You should trust God. In verse 36, fear your God. This is the redeeming God who brought them out of the land of Egypt and is giving them the land of Canaan. In other words, he's delivered them from slavery and he's giving them a place to dwell. And God is saying, you do that for your relatives. Help deliver them from their destitute situation and give them a place to dwell. In verse 39, if your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave, and that means in a ruthless way. That'll be clearer in a moment. In verse 40, he shall be with you as a hired servant and as a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. This is assuming that an Israelite can go and work for another Israelite. There might be a benefactor, someone in a home that needs labor done, or someone to whom you owe money. You've incurred a debt. So you can go and you can, what it means by sell yourself, you are giving your labor. You are giving your labor. And what most of the time this would mean is you would become a member of that person's household. You would become a servant or an indentured laborer in their household. And you would do work. You would earn money. You would receive housing and food. And so in verse 39, one way to deal with debt you have is to put yourself in contract with someone else that you can work off your debt for. And normally you would see the person working debt off for the person to whom they owed the debt. Now, it is conceivable that you could work for one person in order to pay off the debt you owe to someone else. That's also a possible situation as well. This just means, though, Israelites are to help take care of Israelites, help them with faithful labor as long as the debt needs to be paid off. In verse 40, it says at the end, he shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. This means that this release is guaranteed so that this labor, this contract is for the years leading up to Jubilee. And then he's released or she is released from debt. Now, in verse 41, then he shall go out from you, he and his children with him, and go back to his own clan. and return to the possession of his fathers. Oh, what a joyous day that would be, right? All of a sudden, you who have been displaced, you've not been at your home, you've not been with your clan or your family, you've not been at your land. The year of Jubilee means you return with you, your children, back to your clan, returning to the possession of your fathers. Verse 42, for they are my servants, says the Lord, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt, and they shall not be sold as slaves. And that just means they're not in a position of destitution and ruthless slavery like was the case in Egypt. That's what he means in verse 42 when he says, I brought them out of the land of Egypt. So they're not going to return to a kind of life that looks like Egyptian slavery. No, not at all. God says, they're my servants and I brought them out. In verse 43, you shall not rule over him, your Israelite laborer. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly, but you shall fear your God. Have you noticed how multiple times in Leviticus 25, it says you shall fear your God? Fear your God. You are to not exploit the vulnerable. You are not to financially seek to profit from those whose destitution would mean greater misery and compounded sorrow. Instead, you are to be merciful and redeeming, in fact, giving someone the opportunity to work off their debts. And in some cases, if you were a near relative, you could redeem their situation for them out of grace. In verse 43, you are not to engage in ruthlessness over anyone who labors for you. And that is reminding us of Exodus chapter 1, when the Egyptians were ruthless over the Israelites and had subjected them to bitterness and slavery in a way that God said you will never make someone return to. In verse 44, as for your male and female slaves whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around you. This means that part of your indentured workers can include non-Israelites. You may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around you. Verse 45, you may buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their clans that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. And all that, I know that may sound rough and harsh on the face of it. This does not deny their personhood or their value. To be your property is another way of saying here, they are your workers. You have a contractual agreement with them, and you can support Israelites in that work. You can also have strangers who need work, Gentiles, non-Israelites who need work. They can also be at your employ, and you would be able to provide for them, not be ruthless to them, and they will be your laborers. This is not to deny any of their personhood or value, and nor is it something that would be a moral outrage or transgression. The Gentiles or strangers would want to be in this kind of situation if they are entering into a contract. In other words, they see it as necessary. They look at this and they say, we have debts or we have needs, and we're going to pursue this arrangement or this benefactor or this household, and we will be able to gain resources, enrich our finances, pay off our debts. This was not an involuntary system at all. In verse 46, you may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your brothers, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another ruthlessly. He's reminding them here that you are not to be a ruthless taskmaster. That's what the Egyptians were like, and you're not to be that way. But the Israelites were to enjoy the Jubilee year, and that was something unique to the Israelites. The strangers or the non-Israelites could continue working out their arrangement. And this might mean that they were contracted to work for you more years than might be the case after you die. And so someone else may be able to oversee the fulfillment of that agreement and relationship. And that's what it means in verse 46, that you bequeath them to your sons. So your death does not mean the release of their obligations, but rather the fulfillment of their obligations takes precedent. In verse 47, if a stranger or a sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor, and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him, or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. What verses 47 through 49 are envisioning is not only do you have the option to go and join the household of an Israelite to pay off your debts, you could go to a stranger or a non-Israelite who's become rich, and you would be able to benefit from them. If, in other words, the Gentile is the wealthy one and your Israelite brother is the poor one, he may need, or she may need, to go and work for someone who is not an Israelite. The option here in verse 48 is that after that contract exists, one of your fellow Israelites, one of your near relative redeemers, may satisfy the financial requirements in that contract and pay off your debt. And that would free you. It says in verse 49, it could be your uncle, your cousin, a close relative from your clan, or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. This means the Israelite at the end of verse 49 might be able to be in such a prosperous situation that he only works for a non-Israelite for a certain period of time before he's able to free himself from his obligations. He's able to purchase his own liberty, in other words. In verse 50, he shall, if he does this, shall calculate with his buyer from the year when he sold himself to him until the year of Jubilee. And the price of his sale shall vary with the number of years. The time he was with his owner shall be rated as the time of a hired servant. In other words, the nearer you are to the year of Jubilee, the lower the amount that you would owe. But the farther away you are from the year of Jubilee, the more years of labor you would need to pay off for redemption. I hope that makes sense. The year of Jubilee is that guidepost. In verse 51, if there are still many years left, he shall pay proportionately for his redemption, some of his sale price. If there remain but a few years until the year of Jubilee, he shall calculate and pay for his redemption in proportion to his years of service. Again, the year of Jubilee is the guidepost, and you are to be fair and not try to say, I need to pay just a little bit to be redeemed out of my situation when maybe you have, 20 years until the year of Jubilee. You would need to be fair in your dealings and honoring to your contract. In verse 53, he shall treat him, the benefactor, treating the Israelite, that is, the benefactor or the employer, shall treat the servant year by year. He shall not rule ruthlessly over him in your sight. And if he is not redeemed by these means, then he and his children with him shall be released in the year of Jubilee. For it is to me that the people of Israel are servants. They are my servants whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And so that completes the 55 verses. And I know that's a long chapter. And they are building on the hope that while we are in an undesirable situation of debt, that there is a release and liberty coming for the people of God. This hope of redemption from a near relative, a redeemer in your family, was a foreshadowing of the greater truth that we are in a destitute situation in our sin in a fallen world. And we need someone greater than us and more powerful than us to redeem us. The human redeeming activity, in other words, prepares us for the divine redemption we needed. Now, we're reminded in this very chapter that God's already acted with redeeming power. He delivered Israel from Egypt. So he has already shown deliverance in a period of destitution and oppression. And God would do it again. In fact, the prophets look to the year of Jubilee in Leviticus as a forerunner or a preview of what they wanted for all people. One example would be in the book of Micah and in the book of Zechariah. They are longing for things to be made right and restored. In Micah 4:4, there's language about everybody returning to their own vine and fig tree. We are longing for things to be made right. We can feel the need for that in this world. There is a disjointedness and a fracture, a brokenness in creation due to the fall and the curse of sin. The year of Jubilee is hope-giving. The year of Jubilee says God is about redemption. God wants to restore and set things right. And in Isaiah 61, we have a really wonderful prophecy that points to this reality as well. Isaiah 61 says in verse 1, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, I want to pause there for a moment. Proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. In Isaiah 61, what is the year of the Lord's favor that the Spirit of the Lord upon this individual would empower him to proclaim? The year of the Lord's favor is Jubilee language. That was the favor of God that brought liberty. So in verse 1, liberty to the captives, good news to the poor, binding up the brokenhearted. All of this has a background of the Jubilee cycles. So this is a speaker in Isaiah 61 who says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to bring good news, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty in the year of the Lord's favor." Isaiah 61 is saying there's a Jubilee coming. A figure will one day be able to say truthfully and full on in the face, "I have the Spirit of the Lord, news for the poor and the vulnerable and the destitute, and I've come to proclaim liberty." Now, when did that day come? Well, in Luke chapter 4, Jesus is at his Nazareth synagogue, where his hometown was, the synagogue where he grew up, and he asks for the scroll of Isaiah. In Isaiah 61, he opens and he reads from this very passage that I read to you a moment ago. And he proclaims that he's the one anointed by the Spirit to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. This means Jesus is saying, "I have come to bring the Jubilee that creation longs for. I've come to bring the release and the liberation that creation needs." The book of Daniel taps into this as well. One of the more challenging parts of Daniel is in Daniel chapter 9, where the vision of the 70 weeks is given. And it talks about 70 sevens. It talks about seven sevens, but multiplies it to 70 sevens. Now, why is Daniel 9 playing on the notion of sevens? Daniel 9 is using sevens as the root number there because of Leviticus 25. Daniel was ready for the people of God to be delivered out of Babylon, to be released from their captivity, from that new Egypt situation in Babylon, and return to the promised land. But Gabriel comes to Daniel in Daniel 9 and says, "You have been reading about the years of captivity that are coming to an end, the release that's coming. I want to tell you about something even greater. I want to tell you about something farther away beyond your days. I want to tell you about 70 sevens." So just as 7 times 7 equals 49, 70 times 7 equals 490. It's just like how 49 years prepares you for a Jubilee. The 70 sevens prepare the reader for the ultimate celebration, release, and Jubilee. In Daniel 9:24, he says that there will be atonement for sin, the bringing in of everlasting righteousness, an end of sacrifice and transgression. When Jesus dies on the cross and says, "It is finished," when Jesus has lived the life we should have lived, and he died the death that we deserved under the judgment of God, but he satisfied it in our place as a faithful substitute, Jesus has launched for us the Jubilee that sinners need. He has brought in the righteousness that we need, the atonement that we need, because we have debts that we have incurred against the Lord. And Christ has come to set us free. Christ has come to bring his messianic age of liberty, and we get to enact that. It's very obvious that when we are living in relationships with sinners, we are going to wrong each other. And what Matthew 6 tells us is that we should pray for the Lord to forgive our debts as we forgive our debtors. In Matthew 18, there's a very powerful parable about the people who've been forgiven much and who act in forgiveness. So here's one of the ways we apply the year of Jubilee. We are eager to be people who forgive sinners. We are to be living out, embodying Jubilee in our relationships, in our families, in our workplaces, in our churches. Forgiveness is an act of Jubilee. And so Jesus has come to bring the celebratory news of the kingdom in our midst. He's come to cancel the debt of sin against us because of his work on the cross that we receive by faith. And you know what forgiven sinners do? Those who receive God's mercy, they want to be merciful to others. They want to live out the Jubilee life. They want to extend forgiveness, and they don't want to hold debts against others because they know what God has forgiven them. They are grateful. They delight in his mercy. We should praise God that in Leviticus 25, then, we see this important year that Israel would celebrate, a year of Jubilee. And it points forward to the day when Christ would come and inaugurate his ministry as the Spirit-anointed Messiah. He would be the one to bring liberty. Liberty is our present, and liberty is our future, because the work of Christ has been inaugurated and it will not fail. And we praise the Lord for that truth.